small business income. Do you think owners will just accept that loss of net income, or do you think that perhaps they might try to cut expenses, like salaries? The question I always ask people who make this argument is a simple one. How can you create jobs by taking more money away from the people who do the hiring? I'm still waiting to hear a good logical answer.
Well, if we can't raise taxes on anyone, then how the heck are we going to balance this budget?
Finally, a good question. Unfortunately, you've fallen prey to the tax myth. The way this one goes is that prior to President Obama riding into the White House on a white horse, all essential government investments were basically neglected. Hate-mongering conservatives spent years cutting taxes as an ugly plot to starve the beast of government, resulting in a severe decline of federal revenues that forced us to neglect important priorities like caring for sick children. According to the myth, the only way out of this mess is to now reinvest in all the vital programs that were starved for funding from 2001 to 2008. It's a great story, but it's just that, a story. Federal spending before the Obama administration took over expanded from $1.8 trillion in 2000 to $3 trillion in 2008. That's a 66% increase in just 8 years. Raise your hand if you saw your income grow by 66% over that time.
ADD moment. Quick, put it back down before somebody in the Obama administration sees you. Shh, quick.
I'm looking at a chart comparing government spending in some major areas that we're continually told need more funding. The total inflation rate over the period of 2001 to 2008 was 22%. But transportation spending was up 43%. Healthcare spending was up 46%. The Department of Education budget was up more than 85%. Welfare spending was up 60%. It looks to me like the people who have been the most greedy were the lobbyists, politicians, and beltway bureaucrats who run these programs, most of which grew by 4, 5, or 6 times the rate of inflation. If that is neglect, I'd hate to see what happens when our politicians really start spending. Remember, all of these figures are from before the Obama torrent of spending began. In 2009, the average federal program saw an increase of 48%. That's more than 30 times the rate of inflation. And while Bush deserves much of the blame, his last budget pegged 2009 spending at $3.1 trillion. President Obama has taken things to a whole new stratosphere. His latest estimates put 2009 spending at $4 trillion, an increase of $900 billion. That is larger than the economies of Norway and Austria combined. Is it any wonder that we're losing jobs in manufacturing, business services, construction, wholesaling, financial services, but we're gaining jobs in government? Government is great! From April 2008 to April 2009, the private sector lost 5.4 million jobs, but the public sector, they added 162,000 jobs. I guess it helps to have a blank taxpayer check available to make payroll with. Since 2007, the only three sectors of the economy that have created jobs are 1, government, 2, education, and 3, healthcare. Of course, education and healthcare are practically adjuncts of government at this point anyway. But let me ask you the obvious question. Somebody has to pay for these government jobs, right? Of course, and they're being paid for with tax dollars. But if we aren't creating private jobs so that the overall tax base increases, then where is the money coming from? After all, we can't have everyone sitting inside the wagon. We still need some people available to pull it.
Oh, Glenn, what an old-fashioned way of thinking. Don't you understand that government spending is an economic stimulus? Because of the multiplier effect. Every dollar of government spending will generate $2, $3, maybe even $4 of private sector expansion.
Remember the mythical tooth fairy that we always looked forward to? Guess what? She really exists. Her name is Nancy Pelosi, and while she may not look like you expected, she's just as generous. Except she doesn't hand out quarters, she hands out billion-dollar checks, courtesy of the U.S. government. Oh, and the money doesn't go to good little children, but to the good little lobbyists and union leaders that leave her favors under their pillows. as I flip through President Obama's budget, which is as thick as the Manhattan phone book, and I observe the 9,000 subsidy programs that give money to Harry and take more from Louise, all I really see is more and more spending for nearly every government program imaginable. Remember the stimulus bill with its $787 billion price tag and money for the National Education Association, unemployment insurance, windmills, new cars for federal bureaucrats and the like? When you put that spending on top of the regular operating budget, you find that spending for the average government agency increased by about 50%. In other words, at a time when families were pulling back on their spending and suffering through a deep recession, Uncle Sam was living higher on the hog than ever before. If you haven't figured out my point by now, it's that the answer to how we can balance the budget without burying the rich in taxes is easy. We have to balance the budget. In other words, we've got to bring our spending side, which I'm pretty sure I've proven is completely out of control, down to match our revenues, not the other way around. Government is great! The government had so much money to spend in 2009 that it actually contemplated allocating $5 million for the care of cats and dogs in foreign countries. No one in Washington seems to care, though, because $5 million is nothing but a rounding error in the $108 billion that President Obama wants to give to the International Monetary Fund, IMF, in foreign aid this year. In fact, he wanted the IMF to have the money so bad that he was willing to compromise the security of our troops by agreeing to release torture photos in exchange for the votes. Maybe those in the Capitol haven't received the memo yet, but we should be on the receiving end of that foreign aid.
Oh, I know you're not a fan of spending, but the only way out of a deep recession is for the government to take on more debt and help generate new jobs.
We now know that a major trigger point for the recession was too much spending that we couldn't afford. Households accumulated too much credit card and mortgage debt. Businesses took on too much leverage. Think of Bear Stearns with its debt-to-asset ratio of more than 35 to 1. And the federal government took on more debt than any other institution in the history of the world. We also know that most of this debt was used to finance absurdly wasteful spending. Individuals bought televisions, vacations, cars, and granite countertops. The government bought entitlement expansion, wars, and federal bailouts. Maybe I need some advanced degree in economics from the People's Republic of Harvard or a Nobel Prize to understand this, but if excessive debt caused the economic crisis, then how is more debt supposed to get us out of it? Is the idea to borrow more and more money to pay off all the people we borrowed money from over the last 20 years? If so, then isn't that exactly what got Bernie Madoff thrown into prison for 150 years? It's ironic that when individuals rob Peter to pay Paul, they end up having to be careful in the shower. Yet, when the government runs the same kind of Ponzi scheme, we call it an economic stimulus. No wonder Washington is called America's only work-free drug zone.
Glenn, you need to read history. The New Deal resulted in tons of new spending, and it got us out of the greatest depression ever.
Sorry, no. As Bert Folsom has proven in his book, New Deal or Raw Deal, FDR's economic recovery plan was an absolute bust. Federal spending as a share of GDP more than doubled in the 1930s, but the unemployment rate stayed high throughout the decade. Shouldn't all of that money have created lots of new, non-government jobs? By 1940, 8 years after the New Deal was launched, the U.S. unemployment rate was still hovering around 15%. Wow. That's some success story. To put that into perspective, it would be like the United States having a 15% unemployment rate in 2016 and everyone celebrating the success of Obamanomics. Even Henry Morgenthau, FDR's own Treasury Secretary, acknowledged that the blizzard of government spending didn't create new American jobs. Testifying in front of the House Ways and Means Committee in 1939, Morgenthau said, "We have tried spending money. We're spending more than we have ever spent before, and it does not work. And I have just one interest. And now if I'm wrong, somebody else can have my job. I want to see this country prosperous. I want to see people get a job. I want to see people get enough to eat. We have never made good on our promises. I say after 8 years of this administration, we have just as much unemployment as when we started, and enormous debt to boot. I guess Tim Geithner was too busy not paying his taxes to heed Morgenthau's advice.
Okay, what about Japan? Their government had to spend a lot to get out of the lost decade.
Japan tried eight, yes, eight fiscal stimulus plans in the 1990s and early 2000s to end their nearly two-decade-long depression that began in 1991. They basically paved over the whole island with public works programs and then started paving over the ocean, literally, to build the world's most expensive airport once they got done with that. What was the result of all that borrowing and broken window, i.e. you break all the windows in a house and then pay someone to fix them? Stimulus spending? In 1991, the Japanese Nikkei stock index stood at 30,000. By 2007, after spending the equivalent of at least $1.4 trillion in today's U.S. dollars on stimulus packages, the Nikkei was at 12,000. After 16 years of government pump priming, 60% of the country's financial wealth had disappeared. But sure, by all means, why wouldn't we want to emulate that model? Given the obvious failure of big spending programs in the past, we have good reason to be worried about the current one. In comparison to other major spending initiatives throughout American history, the stimulus plan is number one. By far, it is larger than the Marshall Plan, the Apollo Plan to put a man on the moon, the Louisiana Purchase, the Civil War, Reconstruction, or World War I. In fact, we've spent more money to fight this recession than America spent to defeat the Nazis and Japanese in World War II. Over the next 10 years, the Obama budget chains America to a future of $15 to $16 trillion of debt. That is obviously unsustainable and will unquestionably lead to inflation and a declining U.S. dollar. No nation in history has ever devalued its way to prosperity, but U.S. policymakers are giving it their best effort. During the Bush years, the dollar fell relative to virtually every other major currency, and in late 2007, it reached a new symbolic and ignominious low, falling below the Canadian dollar in value for the first time ever. If you think I'm exaggerating the crisis, I know I have that reputation for some reason, then look at how our government is financing all of its debt. The money supply over the past 10 years was consistently stable until about the summer of 2008, and then all hell broke loose. You don't have to have a PhD in Obamanomics to understand what the inevitable consequence of this will be. Say hello to my little friend Inflation.
Yeah, but this time it's different. Besides, we couldn't just sit by and let the economy collapse. We've got to do something.
No one knows for sure how much the government has spent so far to stimulate the economy. After all, who can count that high? But if you add up the cost of all the bailout plans, stimulus measures, debt measures, and all the spending by the Federal Reserve Bank to buy up bad assets, the figure is near $3 trillion. President George W. Bush and his Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson said that if we didn't bail out the banks and big investment houses like Bear Stearns and AIG, the economy would collapse like a house of cards. So they asked for about $1 trillion in new spending, and our Congress, frightened, confused, or both, agreed. When Barack Obama was elected, the economy was still headed south, and we were told that another trillion in spending and bailouts was essential. In addition, the Federal Reserve Bank, made up of unelected officials who helped usher in the crisis through policies that encouraged excessive money creation, decided to intervene on their own and spend another trillion. Saying that we had to unleash all of that debt to prevent the economy from collapsing is a little like what the barbarians used to say when they ransacked Europe. We had to burn the cities in order to save them. It's a great line for another reason as well. There's no way to disprove it. We can, however, look at specific spending programs and measure their effectiveness. The federal government has already committed over $80 billion to bailing out GM, Chrysler, and GMAC. That's $80 billion to save roughly 320,000 jobs. To put that into perspective, we could have given every worker at these companies a $250,000 check, and it would have been cheaper than all these bailouts. And that's assuming that $100 billion is the end of it, which is probably a bad assumption, unless you think that Uncle Sam and the United Auto Workers are somehow going to produce profitable cars. My point is that we are wasting money on such a massive scale that we've lost any sense of reality. The $787 billion we spent on the stimulus plan is supposed to create 3.5 million jobs. Good luck. But if that does somehow happen, it would mean a cost to taxpayers of about $225,000 per job. Again, I know it's a rhetorical question, but couldn't we have just given 3 million unemployed people that money and called it a stimulus? So why hasn't the economy roared back to life in response to all this vital spending? Simple. Because government money doesn't appear out of thin air. It has to come from one of three places. Number one, taxes. The government could take the money right out of your wallet and magnanimously give it to someone else. But redistribution is not stimulus. The net effect on the economy is basically zero. Number two, borrowing. Please, China, can we have some more? When we borrow, we put $1 into the economy, but we also add a dollar plus interest to our liabilities. That's a net decrease in future growth. Three, printing. The government can always call up the Treasury and tell them to keep printing those $100 bills 24/7. But when the government prints an additional dollar, every dollar that you and I have in our wallet or our savings account is worth a tiny bit less. Supply and demand, right? So printing money is just a way of taxing people without their permission, and it results in no positive economic growth. The point is that government spending as an economic stimulus is an illusion. We don't create any new wealth or jobs. We just redistribute money from people who pay taxes or hold dollars to people who helped our politicians get elected. Government is great! Among the biggest donors to the Democratic Party in the 2006 and 2008 election cycles were the unions. Guess who wound up getting most of the money from the stimulus plan? Guess who gets the Chrysler bailout money? Guess who gets all that education money that is supposed to be for the kids? Yep, the unions. The unions and the unions. Should that be called stimulus or payback?
Oh, you're just the party of no. Whole reason we're in this mess is because of your idiotic Republican economic theories. They're a disaster.
First of all, there have been no real Republican economic policies in place for a long, long time, unless you think that massively expanding entitlement programs is right out of the Reagan playbook. Yes, President Bush cut taxes, and yes, cutting taxes is what Republicans generally want, but Bush missed a key part of the equation, cutting spending as well. Cutting taxes while increasing spending is not a Republican economic theory because it simply doesn't work. Second, I will never defend a party because I don't believe in them anymore. But when someone tries to convince you that the answer to excessive spending and debt is obscene levels of spending and debt, I think you have a responsibility to say, no, enough is enough.
ADD moment. If President Obama, Tim Geithner, Ben Bernanke, and Hank Paulson were the people I was relying on to help get me sober, I'd probably still be a raging alcoholic. On my first day of recovery, as I walked in smelling like Jack Daniels, they'd probably each hand me a fifth and tell me, drinking more, it's the only way you'll ever feel better.
But let's suspend our disbelief for a moment and accept the notion that the government had to do something. Here's an amazing but true statistic. Instead of spending $3 trillion on bailouts to homeowners, banks, insurance companies, Wall Street executives, and car companies, what if we had simply suspended the personal and corporate income taxes for a year until the economy got better? In 2008, the personal and corporate income tax raised about $1.45 trillion. In other words, we could have told every business and every worker in America, you don't have to pay income tax this year if you work, if you invest, if you earn a profit, if you expand your business in hiring. You keep it all. Can you imagine how fast our economy would have grown under that scenario? We would have had more jobs than people to fill them. So why didn't we suspend the tax, even for a few months, as a stimulus? Simple. Because cutting taxes for everyone doesn't allow you to do special favors or properly redistribute income. That's why we have rebate checks that are skewed toward the poor. They tell us it's because the poor are more likely to spend them, but the truth is that we do it that way because it fits the progressive Robin Hood agenda.
You're just being overly dramatic because Democrats are now in charge, you Republican zombie. The government really hasn't grown as much as you say.
When Ronald Reagan entered the White House in 1980, his message to voters was plain and simple. Big government is the problem, not the solution. At the time, federal spending was at just over $500 billion. Now the budget is $4 trillion, a sevenfold increase, even after adjusting for inflation. Federal outlays have increased over 250% since 1980. But let me be very clear. This isn't about the donkey or the elephant. Both parties are to blame for the situation we now find ourselves in. In fact, I think you can make a good case that the Republicans deserve your anger more than the Democrats. At least most Democrats have been fairly honest about their progressive agenda. Republicans have shredded our Constitution while smiling and pretending that they actually care about the principles our founders stood for. The thing that's unleashed the federal leviathan the most since our founding is the concept of entitlements. In 1933, the modern entitlement state was born in the form of the federal government's first and most expensive income transfer program, Social Security. In the 1960s, LBJ launched the Great Society, creating a whole new menu of entitlement programs, chief among them Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps, public housing, and aid to families with dependent children, AFDC. Once created, these redistribution programs were virtually impossible to restrain. It wasn't long before people began to feel like they were in the minority if they weren't taking advantage of some free government program. It got so bad that 20 years ago, author Matthew Leskow, also known as the guy who wears the question mark suits, started writing best-selling books chronicling the thousands of federal programs and agencies that gave out free money. There is a lot of truth to the adage that a system that robs Peter to pay Paul can always count on Paul's support. Unfortunately, if Peter ever decides that he's sick of being robbed and leaves the country, the whole scam falls apart.
ADD moment. 40% of American households now not only don't pay any federal income tax, but actually get money back from the government every single year. Wow, that makes it awfully hard to pass a fiscally responsible policy, doesn't it? But what happens when that number gets to 50%? At that point, the only way you'd ever convince the country to lower taxes and cut government programs would be to convince the 50% of people who don't pay taxes to stay home on election day. Or, since we're shredding the Constitution anyway, why not just restrict voting to those who pay income tax? I mean, I'm just thinking out loud here.
How much of a welfare state have we become? One of every $6 of Americans' income is now a federal or state check or voucher. In 2009, the government will spend an average of $17,000 on each U.S. household, meaning that the government is funding more of Americans' income than at any time since we started keeping records in 1929. For an even more stark illustration of government creep, consider that in 1900, total federal, state, and local expenditures were $33 billion. Now, Americans support a nearly $3 trillion government, an increase of almost 10,000%.
Statistics don't lie, but liars like you, Mr. Beck, use statistics. I heard Al Franken say that at one point. Sure, spending is up 10,000%, but that's because of inflation. Besides, our economy is much larger now than it used to be.
Fair point. So instead of looking at it in dollar terms, let's look at the size of government relative to the size of the economy. Would that be okay with you? In 1900, the federal government consumed less than 5% of total economic output. In 1950, the federal government consumed roughly 15% of total output. In 1999, the federal government consumed roughly 19% of total output. In 2009, the federal government will spend 28.1% of total output and climbing. Happy now?
Okay, fine, but who cares about the size of government anyway? If I have a job, I could care less how much they're spending.
It's really pretty simple. More government means less personal freedom. As economist Walter Williams of George Mason University has noted, if the government can lay claim to half of the fruits of our labor, then we are truly, at most, only half free. But now, even after allocating $10.5 trillion on direct and indirect stimulus ideas over the last 2 years, we still have a $6 trillion national debt, climbing to $16 trillion with the new 10-year budget, and we face another $50 trillion in unfunded liabilities for entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare. Are we even really half free, or is that just wishful thinking?
ADD moment. There are only two problems with a Social Security trust fund. First, there's no trust. Second, no fund either. No. In 2009, the outflow for Social Security was $675 billion, and the inflow was $655 billion. That's a negative of $20 billion cash. Oops. Thanks to the recession, payroll tax recipients are way down because fewer people are working. We've sunk into red ink almost 10 years ahead of schedule.
So now, Social Security appears to be contributing to the massive $1.8 trillion deficit rather than helping to reduce it. That means we now have two deficits, the operating budget and Social Security budget. Add in Medicare and we've got our third. Though it's definitely not the charm. In other words, the government has cost us our freedom by putting us into financial shackles. If you have a job now, that's great, but that shouldn't make you feel confident about the future. After all, it's that kind of short-term pleasure over pain thinking that got us here. We've got a lot of work to do to rebuild our economy and regain our freedom, but here are a few steps. Get the government out of the way. Make the dollar as good as gold again. Pay your bills. Balance your budget. Audit every federal agency and find all the waste that can be cut. Make sure our taxes pay for only the essentials of government, not the frivolous and extravagant. Don't allow those who are beneficiaries of the frivolous and extravagant to decide what the definition of essential is. Ensure our politicians put America's future over their own by instituting term limits at all levels. Government is, in the memorable words of President George Washington, a fearsome master. So how have we permitted it to grow so far beyond its constitutional borders? Easy. We've let Congress rewrite the Constitution virtually every day it's in session without an ounce of oversight from the fourth and most important branch of government, we the people. Members of Congress are sworn to uphold the Constitution, but most seem to be as familiar with its contents as they are with the thousand-page bills they vote for in the middle of the night. Shame on them for trampling the vision of our founding fathers for their own selfish gain. Shame on us for letting them.
Chapter 10, U.S. Presidents, A Steady Progression of Progressives. In July 2007, when the Democratic nomination for president was still very much in the air, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and six other candidates, remember Mike Gravel? Oh, he was great. Gathered for a CNN YouTube debate. The world watched as millions of dollars in technology was used to ask questions that the moderator could have read off index cards. But one question actually managed to elicit a response that should have caused people to take notice. Mrs. Clinton, Rob from California asked, how would you define the word liberal? And would you use this word to describe yourself? Clinton complained for a minute about how the word liberal has taken on a new meaning before going on to describe exactly how she views herself politically. I prefer to use the word progressive, which has a real American meaning, going back to the progressive era at the beginning of the 20th century. I consider myself a modern progressive, someone who believes strongly in individual rights and freedoms, who believes that we are better as a society when we're working together, when we find ways to help those who may not have all the advantages in life to get the tools that they need to lead a more productive life for themselves and their family. So I consider myself a proud modern American progressive. And I think that's the kind of philosophy and practice that we need to bring back to American politics. Is it possible that Hillary hasn't gotten the memo? But there's no need, really, to bring progressivism back, because it never left. Sure, the ideas have evolved somewhat, and progressive politicians are a little more careful about how they advertise themselves, but the progressive agenda has been steadily chugging along for over a century. To really understand where America is headed, you first have to understand where we've been and what motivates those who believe that our founding documents must evolve because they were written in a different era. Here's a look back at three presidents from the progressive era. As you listen to their thoughts and vision for America, you might recognize some stark parallels to today's crop of politicians from both sides of the aisle. Just remember, no matter what progressives say or promise, they all have the same fundamental misconception. Our founding fathers didn't set up a system that was meant to adapt to a changing world. It's the other way around.
Teddy Roosevelt.
Roosevelt was a great Republican. If conservatives would just become more like him, we might finally get this party back on track.
Teddy Roosevelt assumed the presidency after William McKinley was assassinated in 1901, a time when large multi-state corporations were first being created. Right out of the gate, Roosevelt fired off 40 lawsuits in an attempt to trust bust and federally control large corporations. Roosevelt, like other progressives, did not trust businesses or wealthy individuals because he likely didn't believe that any of them were ultimately capable of doing what was best for the collective. Only government was capable of that. Please resume listening once you finish laughing.
ADD moment, as you listen to this section, remember that John McCain said that Teddy Roosevelt was his political idol. It won't take long for you to realize just how horrible a selection the GOP really made.
In 1910, Roosevelt gave a landmark speech called The New Nationalism that clearly laid out his vision for America. It has become entirely clear, he said, that we must have government supervision of the capitalization, not only of public service corporations, including particularly railways, but of all corporations doing an interstate business. To progressives, government supervision is the answer to any problem supposedly caused by the free market. It happened after the 1907 banking crisis, the Great Depression, and of course, after the credit crisis when President Obama proposed sweeping changes to the financial regulatory system. Roosevelt continued, "I have no doubt that the ordinary man who has control of meat, oil, coal, or other large important companies is much like ourselves. I have no doubt he would like to do well, but I want to have enough supervision to help him realize that desire to do well." In other words, progressives believe that everyone innately wanted to do what was best for society, but just in case they succumbed to greed or selfishness for a minute, there would be government supervision in place to help them see the error of their ways. Roosevelt not only distrusted the rich, he actually seemed to despise them, while delivering a standard populist line about the need for justice to be administered to all equally. Roosevelt couldn't help but slip in his hatred for the upper class.
"And the wealthy man, whomsoever he may be, for whom I have the greatest contempt, I would fight for him, and you would if you were worth your salt."
Greatest contempt for the wealthy man? This was a Republican? Yes, but you have to understand that progressivism has nothing to do with the R or the D. Progressive politicians from opposite parties may have different methods for achieving their goals, but those goals are always the same: benefiting the collective at the expense of the individual. Remember Hillary's words from the debate as she described progressivism: "We are better as a society when we are working together." Roosevelt continued, "We grudge no man a fortune in civil life if it is honorably obtained and well used. It is not even enough that it should have been gained without doing damage to the community. We should permit it to be gained only so long as the gaining represents benefit to the community." Progressives like Roosevelt would, on the surface, seem to defend capitalism, but there is almost always a big if attached to their rhetoric. in Roosevelt's case, saying that someone can make boatloads of cash if they obtain it honorably is one thing. You can at least make the case that he meant lawfully. But if their wealth is well used? What does that mean? And who exactly decides the definition of well used? Some government board? He went on, "This, I know, implies a policy of a far more active governmental interference with social and economic conditions in this country than we have yet had. But I think we have got to face the fact that such an increase in government control is now necessary." Of course it's now necessary. There's no other way to achieve the progressive agenda without a far more active government. After all, could a small, limited government ever help usher in a philosophy like this? "Every man," Roosevelt said, "holds his property subject to the general right of the community to regulate its use to whatever degree the public welfare may require it." Notice the language, public welfare. You can have property so long as the greater good doesn't require that the government take or regulate it. Government controls your business. Government controls your money. Government controls your property. Government controls your life. As most conservatives understand, creating and implementing progressive government programs to solve problems only leads to more government control. For example, the Hepburn Act of 1906 gave the Interstate Commerce Commission, ICC, the power to, among other things, replace existing railroad rates with just and reasonable rates. Take a wild guess at who got to define what was just and reasonable. Yep, the Roosevelt administration's ICC. When you cut through all of the noise, that is nothing more than government wage control, a big step past progressivism and right toward socialism or worse. Of course, another thing that most real conservatives understand is that whenever government tries to solve a problem, they create another one, usually much bigger than the original. Because of the caps on railway rates, the value of railroad securities plummeted. Turns out investors aren't so fond of government price controls. Who knew? Helping cause the bank panic of 1907. That gave progressives a new problem to solve. What to do? What to do? Let me put my progressive thinking cap on for a second. Wait, I know. We need more government supervision. Roosevelt's answer was to create the National Monetary Commission, which just 5 years later led to the creation of the Federal Reserve System. The banking panic of 1907 was calmed in large part by J.P. Morgan and his efforts to pull together funds, both public and private, and inject them into the banking system. But given Roosevelt's distaste for corporations and wealth, Morgan's contributions must have been frowned on, right? Nope. Ironically enough, Mr. For the People, Mr. Darn These Special Interests, Mr. Trustbuster himself, Teddy Roosevelt, thanked Morgan by allowing him to expand his steel empire and buy the Tennessee Coal and Iron Company for $45 million, about 5% of its true market value. I guess all those values and principles that Roosevelt held so dear went right out the window once he realized that only capitalism could save America from the disasters created by progressivism. Woodrow Wilson.
Wilson was a model Democrat and a great American. Even most Republicans like him.
Wilson is routinely rated as one of the top 10 presidents of all time, and truthfully, he made my list as well, but it has a slightly different title, the top 10 bastards of all time. Pardon the language, but Wilson's assault on the First Amendment was like nothing this country has seen before or since from anyone who's taken an oath to protect and defend our Constitution. Wilson believed that our rights didn't come from our Creator. They came from the government, and his reasoning was influenced by one of his favorite political theorists, Edmund Burke. Burke, who was from the UK, suggested that a man should consider his rights as an Englishman rather than simply a man. He opposed the abstract, arguing instead that politicians must place themselves in the here and now and base their political principles in historical reality.
The less you know. Edmund Burke is commonly considered to be the founder of modern conservatism, with Wilson, an ardent liberal, being influenced by Burke, a conservative icon. It's not hard to see when the poisonous political crossbreeding began.
Does your head hurt yet? It only gets worse. Wilson, who was president of Princeton University before taking the White House, was apparently just waiting to make a big theoretical discovery when one fell right in his lap.
I had been casting around in my mind for something by which to draw several parts of my political thought together, when it was my good fortune to entertain a very interesting Scotsman who had been devoting himself to the philosophical thought of the 17th century. His talk was so engaging that it was delightful to hear him speak of anything, and presently there came out of the unexpected region of his thought the thing I had been waiting for.
This is what they call in the business a cliffhanger. Can't you just feel the excitement? What did the Scotsman tell Wilson?
Editor's note. If you are currently feeling 1 ounce of excitement to find out what some intellectual Scotsman told Woodrow Wilson over 100 years ago, then seriously, you really need to get a life.
I won't leave you in suspense any longer. It's just too cruel. The thing that Wilson had been waiting for was a theory to prove that the United States Constitution is a living document.
The Scotsman called my attention to the fact that in every generation, all sorts of speculation and thinking tend to fall under the formula of the dominant thought of the age.
I know what you're thinking. Huh? It's hard for us non-intellectuals to understand such deep tweed jacket thinking, but fortunately Wilson clarified his new understanding for us.
The makers of our federal constitution constructed a government as they would have constructed an orrery to display the laws of nature. Politics, in their thought, was a variety of mechanics. The constitution was founded on the law of gravitation. The government was to exist and move by virtue of the efficacy of checks and balances. The trouble with this theory is that government is not a machine, but a living thing. It falls not under the theory of the universe, but under the theory of organic life. It is accountable to Darwin, not to Newton. Society is a living organism and must obey the laws of life, not of mechanics. It must develop. All that progressives ask or desire is permission in an era when development, evolution, is the scientific word to interpret the Constitution according to the Darwinian principle. All they ask is recognition of the fact that a nation is a living thing and not a machine.
First of all, could you imagine spending 5 minutes with this guy? I would have killed myself as soon as the word orrery came out. Who, besides Keith Olbermann, actually talks like that? Given Wilson's clearly articulated views during the campaign, it shouldn't be surprising that, after beating Taft and Roosevelt, Wilson fulfilled his own constitutional rape fantasy.
Yeah, but Wilson was brave enough to secure America's future by leading us into World War I.
It wasn't so much leading us into the war that I care about. It's what he did after that. Wilson felt it was a priority to make sure that anything interfering with the war effort was stopped, including, unfortunately, those who disagreed with it. That's why, shortly after the war began, he pushed through the Espionage Act, a grotesque attack on free speech that made it a crime
to convey false reports or false statements with intent to interfere with the operation or success of the military or naval forces of the United States, or to promote the success of its enemies when the United States is at war, to cause or attempt to cause insubordination, disloyalty, mutiny, refusal of duty in the military or naval forces of the United States, or to willfully obstruct the recruiting or enlistment service of the United States.
Violating that act was punishable by a maximum $10,000 fine, almost $170,000 in today's dollars, and 20 years in prison, almost 20 years in today's time. If it was in place during the Iraq War, every single person at the New York Times would probably be in jail or broke. But Wilson didn't think that act was restrictive enough, so he pushed through an amendment to it called the Sedition Act, which added this key clause.
And whoever, when the United States is at war, shall willfully utter, print, write, or publish any disloyal, profane, scurrilous, or abusive language about the form of government of the United States, or the military or naval forces of the United States, or the flag, or any language calculated to bring any of those things into contempt, scorn, contumely, or disrepute, or shall willfully utter, print, write, or publish any language intended to incite, provoke, or encourage resistance to the United States, or to promote the cause of its enemies, shall be punished by a fine of not more than $10,000, or imprisonment of not more than 20 years, or both.
Notice the word utter is used several times. Wilson wasn't just concerned with the media. He was worried about private citizens uttering things in private conversations. I guess those of us who think that's an assault on free speech are just close-minded idiots who don't see our nation as a living thing. And to those modern-day progressives who are so keen to look back at Wilson with nostalgia, how do you feel knowing that if he were president in 2004, he probably would have wanted you serving 10 to 20 years in a federal prison? Eugene Debs, who received a respectable number of votes as a socialist candidate for president, saw firsthand that Wilson wasn't bluffing. On June 18, 1918, Debs gave a speech about the wonders of socialism. Just 9 months later, he was in prison, sentenced to 10 years for committing hate speech crimes in violation of Wilson's Sedition Act.
The less you know. The Sedition Act, at first, made it possible for the Postmaster General to deny mail delivery to dissenters of government policy during wartime. How would Olbermann have survived without his monthly delivery of Cosmo Girl?
Anyone who's listened to me for more than 5 seconds knows that I hate almost everything socialists stand for. But who's worse, a socialist with strong principles but misguided policies, or a president who shreds our own Constitution by tossing people in jail who try to exercise the rights it grants them?
ADD moment. Hey, Hillary, was this the real American meaning of progressivism that you spoke about at the debate?
Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
He was elected 4 times. He was wildly popular.
FDR is another president who is inexplicably ranked near the top of many best presidents ever polls. The fact that he is the only president to ever be elected 4 times is oft cited as proof of his popularity. And popularity, as we all know, always equals competence. The fact that FDR stayed in office for so long isn't proof of his massive popularity. It's proof of his massive ego. Worse, instead of using all of that time to change the country for the better, he used it to do more damage to the framework of America than any other president in history.
ADD moment. Saddam Hussein was elected a lot of times, too. Yeah.
If FDR was so popular, then why did we ratify the 22nd Amendment, which limited future presidents to 2 4-year terms so soon after finally getting FDR out of office? After all, if America had come away from FDR's terms thinking, man, that really worked out well, then you'd think the country would have been in no mood for strict term limits. I don't know this for a fact. I know, you're shocked. But President Obama's chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, probably had a poster of FDR on his bedroom wall while growing up, because FDR was one of the first to realize that you should never let a crisis go to waste. He used economic turmoil and war to make the case for a massive expansion of government, and he used the Great Depression to make people believe that he was the only one who could solve America's problems, when in reality, he was only making them worse.
The country was in a crisis. He had to do something.
On March 4th, 1933, Franklin D. Roosevelt won the election in a landslide. He took office with a lot of political capital, both houses of Congress under Democratic control, and an American public supportive of immediate action. So, FDR delivered, promising a New Deal for Americans who couldn't stand another 4 more years of the same failed Republican policies that Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover had delivered for the last decade.
ADD moment. Actually, that quote about failed policies is from Hillary Clinton in 2008, referring to George W. Bush. But really, I mean, what's the difference?
FDR ran his campaign on a familiar theme: hope, change, and blame. He blamed Hoover for the high unemployment rate, 25%, for fostering the growth of greedy, out-of-control corporations, and for problems with regulation and oversight. He then made the case that the only solution to those problems was through a massive New Deal that would be implemented by the federal government. Oh, and it had to be done quickly. Is any of this sounding familiar? In his first 100 days in office, FDR created a whole bastion of new federal programs and signed at least 15 major pieces of legislation into law. Here's what all of that government spending bought us. Unemployment during the New Deal and New Deal II? 1933, 24.9%. 1934, 21.7%. 1935, 20.1%. 1936, 16.9%. 1937, 14.3%. 1938, 19%. It wasn't until America got thrust into war that the economy rebounded. FDR actually prolonged the Depression with his big government solutions.
FDR didn't want to expand the government so much, but the Depression forced his hand.
While the Depression provided a convenient excuse for FDR's actions, the truth is that he must not have been a very big fan of the Founding Fathers. What other reason could there be for all the do-overs? A New Deal, a second New Deal, and then a second Bill of Rights? I mean, geez, why not just send another declaration to England, apologizing how poorly worded the first one was? Technically, yes, FDR was most likely an American citizen, but the stuff he proposed sounded more like entries from Karl Marx's diary. For example, in his 1944 State of the Union address, he said,
"In our day, these economic truths have become accepted as self-evident. We have accepted, so to speak, a second Bill of Rights, under which a new basis of security and prosperity can be established for all, regardless of station, race, or creed. Among these are the right to a useful and remunerative job in the industries or shops or farms or mines of the nation. The right to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation. The right of every farmer to raise and sell his products at a return which will give him and his family a decent living. The right of every businessman, large and small, to trade in an atmosphere of freedom from unfair competition and domination by monopolies at home or abroad. The right of every family to a decent home. The right to adequate medical care and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health. The right to adequate protection from the economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment. The right to a good education."
That is typical socialist rhetoric that sounds good for the 2 seconds it takes before your brain starts to engage. So let's look at a few of those new rights a little more closely. The right to a useful job. I thought the rights we fought for were life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Maybe Jefferson just forgot to include useful job in there? This is one of those rights that might feel good, but that stands against everything a free market system stands for. Is the owner of a coal mine supposed to hire every 400-pound fatty who shows up with his second Bill of Rights in hand? Is a shop owner required to hire a person who can't communicate with customers because he or she doesn't speak English? If so, then what happens to these businesses? They suffer. Profits decline, bankruptcies ensue, and more Americans are forced to go on the government dole, which is exactly what FDR was probably hoping for. The right to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation. If this one doesn't make you seethe inside, then you can't consider yourself a real lover of capitalism. What is the incentive to study and work hard when you know that you have a government-gifted right to not only earn enough for food and clothing, but also to pay for your entertainment? Supporters of these rights will argue that as the richest nation on earth, we have a responsibility to help our poor. I couldn't agree more. And that's why we have Medicaid, Medicare, S-CHIP, welfare, food stamps, Section 8 housing, shelters, food kitchens, counseling, etc., etc. But taking the next step by making our government the grantor of rights takes America from being the land of opportunity to the land of guarantees. The right of every family to have a decent home. We've tried really hard over the last couple of decades to make FDR's failed dream a reality. And I think we're now all seeing how that kind of thinking turns out. Giving people something, whether it be clothing, recreation, or yes, a home, that's out of proportion with how hard they worked to get it is a recipe for disaster. While I happen to be against homelessness, I know, shocking, we have plenty of safety nets in place to help those who have fallen on truly hard times. In New York City, for example, no family who is in urgent need of shelter is denied it, unless they break a rule by being drunk or high. And while no one would ever consider a homeless shelter a decent home, I think it's fair to say that shelters and support services constitute fulfillment of the obligation to protect the poor and weakest. But FDR couldn't have disagreed with that more. All of these rights spell security, he told Congress, and after this war is won, we must be prepared to move forward in the implementation of these rights to new goals of human happiness and well-being. America's own rightful place in the world depends in large part upon how fully these and similar rights have been carried into practice for our citizens. At his 1944 inauguration, it must have been getting old by then, the fourth time is never the charm, FDR said, "People who are hungry and out of a job are the stuff of which dictatorships are made." As usual, he was wrong. The truth is that presidents who overstay their welcome by convincing Americans that the man is more important than the office are the stuff of which dictatorships are made. Progressive Era, Round 2.
The progressive era was just that, an era, okay? It's over. Move on with your life, loser.org.
How I wish that were true. Unfortunately, if you look at the list of presidents since FDR, it would be easier to name the ones who weren't progressives. Let's see, there was Ronald Reagan and, well, honestly, I think Reagan was about it. Over the years, it hasn't seemed to matter whether a Republican or Democrat was in office. The government just kept growing and growing. Very few presidents met an agency, department, or program that they didn't want to create or expand, and our debates have become less about big versus small government and more about obscenely large versus really large government. While it's true that some presidents embraced more progressive ideals than others, virtually all of them have relied on the infamous greater good argument to justify their expansions of government. Lyndon B. Johnson's expansion of Medicare and his Head Start and Job Corps programs were all part of his Great Society, which he described as a place where men are more concerned with the quality of their goals than the quantity of their goods. Jimmy Carter's Department of Education was all about our collective interest in having the federal government get involved with our local schools. "Education is our most important national investment," he wrote in the signing statement. President Bush's Department of Homeland Security was about our collective desire to be safe and secure, and his Medicare Part D prescription drugs bill was in response to our collective obligation to care for our seniors. In fact, when President George W. Bush signed the bill that included Medicare Part D, a massive expansion of government that's added billions to our debt, he gave a quote that seemed to come right out of the progressive handbook. "Medicare is a great achievement of a compassionate government, and it is a basic trust we honor," Bush said. "Each generation benefits from Medicare. Each generation has a duty to strengthen Medicare, and this generation is fulfilling our duty." President Bush's expansion of government was historic, but his records won't last for long if President Obama has his way. While Bush may have been a progressive light, Obama is an extra strength version, a president who seems to be willing to push the progressive agenda farther than most supporters could have ever fathomed. Obama is rewriting America's future, and in some cases, its constitution as well. And he's doing it with blinding speed. Like Teddy Roosevelt, He seems to believe that wealth must be well used. Like Woodrow Wilson, he seems to believe in the idea that our Constitution is a living document. And, like FDR, he seems to believe in the right to health care, a good job, and a decent home. In other words, Obama is like a progressive Frankenstein. A president who's created out of the most grotesquely destructive policies of his predecessors. There's at least one other unintended consequence to all of this. If Americans continue to embrace the new progressive era that President Obama seems so intent on ushering in,